Now that Iraq has regained sovereignty, it still has a way to go before becoming a democracy. My guest, Larry Diamond, is the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He spent much of the first 3 months of this year in Iraq advising the Coalition Provisional Authority. The handover of sovereignty caught everyone by surprise when it took place 2 days before it was planned, avoiding terrorist attacks that may have been timed to coincide with the event. I asked Diamond what he thought of the early handover.
I think it was a brilliant maneuver. You know, the terrorists are constantly taking us by surprise. I think we saw with this shrewd and adept decision, partly driven by concerns on the part of the CPA, our occupation administration, and part by a request from Prime Minister Alawi, we saw the beginning of adaptability on the part of ourselves in kind of outmaneuvering the terrorists. It was a good decision, and probably it was not the time for a grand celebration in any case.
What are the documents that are now governing Iraq and saying what the laws are?
Well, there are several sets of documents. The most important, of course, is the highest one, which is their interim constitution. It's called the Transitional Administrative Law. It was drafted over a period of a few months between December and the end of February. But then there are a number of orders and regulations that were issued by our administrator, L. Paul Bremer III, over the course of the occupation. And those have, for the time being, again, in theory, the force of law.
You've described the Transitional Administrative Law as the most liberal and progressive basic governance document anywhere in the Arab world. What are some of the best parts of this?
Well, I'd like to mention three. First of all, there is a Bill of Rights, a very detailed and encompassing set of guarantees of individual liberties that draw heavily from the principles in our own Bill of Rights, but more importantly in terms of legitimacy in the Arab world, from the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and the International Covenant on Political and Civil Liberties. These guarantee freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, due process of law in very great detail. Secondly, and very importantly in terms of ensuring political stability in the country, the Transitional Administrative Law provides for, in essence, a federal system with some significant delegation of authority down to the level of provinces, which are like our states in a way. There are 18 of them in Iraq. This gives the Kurds, who have a level of government between the provinces in the center called a regional government. And it has retained in this document most of the powers and rights and responsibilities that it has exercised over the last 12 years. This gives the Kurds some security, some sense of dignity, some confidence that their rights and their very lives are not going to be trampled on as they were under Saddam. Third, there is a provision, which some people in the CPA were initially not happy about, but understood the importance of, that guarantees that 25% of all the seats in the national parliament will be held by women. And I think this is a very important principle to establish in an emerging democracy.
How concerned are you about the role of Islam in the new government of Iraq after the transitional period is over?
Well, it could still be a democracy. It just might not be a very liberal one. I personally think, having traveled around the country and studied its politics a little bit, that if there is a free and fair election in Iraq, Iraqis are not going to vote for a strongly, militantly Islamist government. My concern, and this now gets us into the politics of the situation, is that there won't be a free and fair election, that the Shiite Islamist parties have gotten so much money from Iran, have built up their militias to such a powerful degree. There's money pouring in from Saudi Arabia for the Sunni Islamist parties with Wahhabist influence. My concern is that unless the international community in its support role and its mediating role take fairly energetic steps to level the political playing field, to ensure some base of political funding for all political parties, and to make sure that the leading parties are not able to use their militias to intimidate voters, assassinate opponents, and intimidate electoral officials by way of rigging elections, that we could see the real level of support for Islamist parties in Iraq inflated considerably by undemocratic means.
Now, you advised the Coalition Provisional Authority for 3 months, from January through March of 2004. And I believe you were asked to do that by Condoleezza Rice and by Paul Bremer, who was the head of the CPA. Was this the first time that you've put theory into practice and you've actually worked within a country that is in the process of becoming a democracy?
It's the first time I've done it in such an intensive, full-time way, rather than just being in a place for a week or a few days.
Mm-hmm.
I've observed elections in a number of countries, but I've never been working on a transition in quite such a sustained way, particularly in a post-conflict setting.
So give us a good example of a theory you've always held dear, a principle you always held dear, that wasn't really working out that way in Iraq. You know, where the theory didn't fit the reality?
Well, one example that I give people, because most of the theories actually, I think, proved to have some resilience in the face of the crucible of Iraqi politics and violent conflict. But we think that it's a wonderful thing to recruit people to be involved in politics, that we go around and give them courses and training, expose them to different ideas and models, and then they kind of go out and remake their political system. And I remember meeting with the Iraqi Higher Women's Council, and one of the members of the council, who in fact was also a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, got up and said to me, what is the relationship between personal security and the overall political process in the country? And I wasn't quite sure of what she meant. And then, you know, I asked her, and she said, who's going to protect us if we run for office, as you say? If we come and become involved in politics, who's going to keep us alive? And I had seen the links between personal security and the unfolding political transition hit me more and more over a period of time. But this hit me squarely between the eyes, because I realized that these women were really vulnerable. And indeed, one member of the Iraqi Governing Council had already been assassinated. And this woman suffered an assassination attempt some months later, after our meeting, in which her son was killed. And this brought home to me, in a very personal way, the dangers that Iraqis face in trying to rebuild their country and take control over their own politics, and the responsibility we have had, which I think to some considerable extent we have failed on, to provide the climate of security that could enable them to really achieve this goal.
Where do you think we went wrong in providing security in Iraq?
We didn't put in nearly enough troops from the beginning. I think the administration was incredibly stubborn, arrogant, hubristic, willful in insisting that its original vision of a light footprint was going to be adequate. What they didn't understand is that the needs for security in the country after Saddam fell would actually require many more troops than it would take to topple his regime. You know, we've just under-resourced the mission dramatically.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Diamond, and he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also a professor of political science at Stanford and coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford's Institute for International Studies. A lot of the security and a lot of the rebuilding of the infrastructure was contracted to private companies like, you know, Halliburton, Bechtel. Do you think that from the military's point of view and from the CPA's point of view, it worked to outsource so much of that to private contractors?
Let me make some distinctions, Terry. On the construction side, I think we should have done much more through Iraqi companies. I think it was a strategic mistake to put so much money in the hands of a few big external, in this case primarily American, contractors. I saw instances at a kind of local level where building had happened very rapidly by American CPA officials basically paying cash to local Iraqi contractors and giving them incentive bonuses for finishing the job early. A whole complex of democracy training buildings in Hilla got built in a matter of 2 or 3 months. A beautiful training center with, computer stations and 18 different offices, a men's and women's dormitory to house people who'd come to this regional training center, an auditorium. All of this went up in a matter of 3 months by a very different method of contracting. I think there should have been more of that. On the other hand, security was an enormous problem. The only way that people could be safe was essentially by having bodyguards. And having been guarded during my travels by Blackwater private security guards, I am not going to knock this company. I think they were enormously professional and effective in the job they did.
Earlier you said that you think one of the greatest problems that you came upon during the months that you worked in Iraq was the lack of security, and like a woman came up to you and said, yeah, democracy sounds great, but who's going to protect us if we run for office or get involved in politics? That there just wasn't enough security to make an open society possible.
I have written and said repeatedly it was the single biggest obstacle to rebuilding the country politically and economically that dwarfed everything else. We had the people in place. We had the money, $18.6 billion for economic and political reconstruction and support for civil society. We've spent only a tiny fraction of it so far because of the security situation.
Would you explain that to me? How much have we actually spent of the money?
By one account, I've read less than $500 million.
So what's happening to that money, and why hasn't it been spent?
A lot of it is still there to be spent by the new United States Embassy, mm-hmm. the U.S. Agency for International Development, and so on. There was an allocation of funding to the National Endowment for Democracy, and it has made some grants, and it's ready to make more. But, you know, the problem has been that we haven't had sufficient security to actually dispense the money, to actually do the economic reconstruction projects. And much more of the money than we had anticipated had to be spent on hiring basically private security guards.
I don't know how honest you feel you can be about this, but when you were in Iraq working with the Coalition Provisional Authority and also, you know, interacting with the military, did you get the impression that people in the CPA and the military thought that in retrospect, you know, invading a country to help move it toward democracy was a kind of viable model?
Well, I was against the invasion, as you know, but what I found primarily in Iraq among the political officers I was working with, and in fact, most people within the CPA, were proud of what we'd done. And they were proud because they were working with Iraqis who were so grateful to be rid of Saddam. I encountered so many personal stories emotionally told
to the point of people breaking out spontaneously in tears about the terror they felt, the fear they felt, the lives they lost of family members dear to them. And, you know, when you hear these stories and you see the mass graves, it's impossible not to feel that we did something right and good in toppling Saddam.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Larry Diamond is the coordinator of the Democracy Program at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies, and he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution.